of London, he had gotten dust particle suppressants sprayed around air quality monitors to bring down their readings. These deceptive methods are for advanced countries. In impoverished nations, things are different.
For a long time, we didn't have a choice about relying on fossil fuels, but we don't need them anymore. It's time to move towards something better, toward a future built on clean energy from the wind and the sun, electric cars instead of diesel and petrol, less driving, more walking and cycling. It won't be easy to end the era of fossil fuels. They're woven into the fabric of our societies. And there is a lot of money and a lot of power invested in keeping us dependent on them.
In 1952, 7 years after World War II, countries were seeking to accelerate their production. Factories working at full blast every day, millions of tons of charcoal were burnt in the world to help the factories keep producing. London was in ruins due to the Second World War. Those days, it was still the biggest city in the world with a population of 8 million people. Almost all of the population and the factories around London used charcoal to supply energy. December 5th, 1952 went down in history forever. In just 4 days, the sulfuric steam claimed 4,000 lives. The figure later rose to 12,000 people. About 100,000 people were infected with various diseases. Officials throughout the United Kingdom introduced a strange strategy to eradicate the mysterious disease. Soon, everyone was talking about offshoring pollution. Today, China is the second largest economy in the world. Many economic analysts believe that the country will take over the U.S. and take the first spot in a few years. The big stride was made thanks to the hard work by millions of laborers in tens of thousands of small and large factories in the country. Everything in the country was developing, even pollution. In Beijing, mothers get up every morning, and first thing in the morning, they go to their children to check if they're still breathing. Preparing breakfast comes next. Everything has to be washed with the water that's purified under the sink. But the water isn't for drinking. They can only drink potable water. That's how a day begins in polluted Beijing. People have to be careful from morning to night. Be careful about the water they drink and the food they eat to make sure they're not polluted. A large population of poor people lives in this city. Living in luxury homes is a dream that will never come true. But when it comes to pollution, people's wealth cannot change anything. According to a survey by Nanjing University, a third of all deaths in China is related to air pollution. The research was carried out in November 2015 on 33 million people in 74 cities in China, and it came to light that 31% of the fatalities are linked to air pollution. The largest number of deaths took place in Hebei province, where Beijing is located and is in the worst condition. In fact, Beijing is made up of two cities, a part of the city where the rich people could enjoy a better air quality and the polluted part where a large number of poor people reside. The rich people live in the cleaner part of the city. On the polluted days, they can go to work in their own cars, have access to better doctors, and have another house in the suburbs to go to and get fresh. Thanks to air purifying machines, the air inside the homes of the richer people in Beijing is purified with more expensive filters. An ordinary purifier costs $4,300 in Beijing. It pumps in the air from the outside and pumps the air into the home after purifying it. But a machine that can completely purify the air and stop carbon dioxide and other pollutants from entering the home with stronger filters costs about $7,200. The filter needs to be changed once a month. Each filter costs $430. A water purification filter costs $300, and the figure can be as high as $1,000. People in Beijing are usually seen with face masks on in the streets. These circumstances have led to the emergence of bizarre products in stores throughout Beijing. For example, a bottle of the UK's air is sold at the exorbitant price of $115. The air that was once the most polluted in the world, but now, thanks to exporting pollution, it is clean. Or at least thanks to the deceptive measure by Boris Johnson, it is passed off as clean. Every year, about 20,000 people in Southeast Asia die due to pollution from burning charcoal. The figure can reach an annual casualty of 70,000 people in 2030. The number of power plants that run on charcoal in Malaysia, as the most populated country in the region after China, has increased to 323 from 147. In Myanmar, we expect to see a five-fold increase, and the current three power plants will increase to 16 charcoal-fueled power plants. Charcoal is inexpensive and has pushed even advanced countries like South Korea and Japan to devise plans to establish fossil fuel power plants, especially charcoal. It can make the situation even worse. But the pollution in Indonesia and Vietnam will be worse. Power plants in those countries are fast mushrooming. You'll be even more shocked if you know that 100,000 people die every year in India because of the complications related to the power plants.
By 2021, diesel fuel here will meet European standards. The government has also promised to shut down old coal-fired plants and restrict new ones. But pollution has been worsening for years. The Indian government says it's taken steps to reduce pollution. But in the meantime, for years to come, India's capital, and for that matter most of its major cities, will continue to be among the most difficult places on Earth to breathe.
China is the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. The country consumes charcoal 40 times more than Indonesia. Only in 2013, 366,000 Chinese lost their lives to bad effects of using charcoal. So why don't the people in China and Southeast Asia do something for themselves to tackle the situation? The answer lies in offshoring pollution. When London and other metropolises in the world face air pollution during the past decades, they came up with a solution. They decided to relocate the factories that cause pollution away from their countries and only manage them from a distance. On paper, the decision would benefit the poorer countries as well because it would create jobs for them and would transfer technology as well. As a result of the decision, thousands of major and minor companies are operating in Southeast Asia, poor African countries, and Latin America. They can produce anything at the lowest cost compared to advanced countries. The reason is the low cost of production in those countries, inexpensive fuel, inexpensive land, and low wages of manpower. Lack of rules and regulations that work as roadblocks and many other factors in these countries turn them into favorite spots for making products, but their citizens do not benefit from it that much, and the only thing they get in return is air pollution, disease, and a meager amount of money that only keeps them afloat. Agyoblushi is a small but famous region in Accra, the capital of Ghana. This is a terminal ward for many things, from cars, tires, and various machines to television sets and many other electric appliances. Every year, about 215,000 tons of electric appliances are sent to Agyoblushi. Only 30% of them are brand new. The rest are second-hand goods that have to be demolished. In fact, people in Ghana are tasked to ruin these devices at this point. After this phase, the only thing that is left from them is smoke, black smoke that's always there in the sky. It contains carbon dioxide, poisonous gases, and any other pollutant you can think of. Most of these goods are sent from rich countries to Ghana as piles of garbage. People in this country do everything to stay alive and eat. Gutting a clunker is the most honorable job in Ghana. After separating the parts, they put aside the useful parts. When they remove the body and the main components, they reach metals that don't reveal themselves so easily, like copper wires that are hidden under plastic covering. The most common way to reach the precious metal is to burn the wire. After the plastic covering is burned, they collect the remaining metal. This is exactly what happens to computers, cables, and electric appliances in the kitchen. It seems damaging, burning, and collecting the leftovers are a win-win for both sides of the deal. One side of the deal gets rid of the garbage and the environmental hazards caused by it, and those on the other side of the deal can eat a few good meals and keep waiting for the cargo ships arrive that are going to bring in the new piles of garbage. The glamorous world today needs to keep producing goods in order to remain sustainable. The goods are advertised every day on billboards. They're put on display in galleries. Many people are ready to stand in long lines for hours to get them. But producing these goods involves expenses, and producers are always desperate to reduce those expenses. In today's world, there has been a simple division of labor. In part of the world, people work all day long in factories and workshops to supply for other people in other parts of the world. In some parts of the world, people create garbage, and people in other parts of the world burn that garbage. In some parts of the world, people live, and in other parts of the world, people are just trying to stay alive. The division of labor is apparently fair based on the slogans, but in practice, something else happens.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, more than half a million appointments and operations have been cancelled due to the strikes by doctors, nurses and paramedics. Specialist doctors in England are demanding an increase in their visiting fees and say that these wages have been lower than annual inflation for a long time. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. National Health Service bosses are braced for a summer of chaos after UK's union leaders suggested a 50% pay hike would not be enough to stop senior doctors from striking. In comments unearthed by The Daily Mail, officials from Doctors' Union, the British Medical Association, BMA, said, if ministers were to offer consultants 50%, it would still be just a drop in the ocean. This is despite NHS consultants already earning an average of £128,000 a year and the union separately demanding a 35% pay rise for junior doctors. The comments from Vishal Sharma and Mike Henley, chairman and deputy chairman of the British Medical Association's Consultants Committee, threatened to escalate the bitter dispute between ministers and health unions. Disputes with nurses and junior doctors remain unresolved in England, raising the prospect of all three coordinating strikes for the first time. Unlike nurses and junior doctors, consultants are yet to strike, but more than 30,000 are being balloted and look certain to vote in favour of industrial action after 86% did so in a test ballot in March. The vote closes at the end of June. In comments made on the little-known Senior Review podcast, Dr. Vishal Sharma said, we now need to start from scratch and say what should a doctor in the United Kingdom in 2023 be paid. We can argue that it should be 50% higher. The government can argue whatever it should be. And I have to say, even 50% is still a drop in the ocean compared to America, Australia and many other places. Dr. Mike Henley added, when you consider the 17 years of training, the stress, difficulty and complexity of what you do, you're worth every penny. Dr. Mike Henley added, so the question to you lot is, what do we do? Do we go on Newsnight and say, we demand a 50% increase? Well, I would, obviously. Britain's Health Secretary Steve Barclay on Sunday, 28th of May, held firm on the government's position, saying it would not improve its pay offer to nurses, which includes a one-off payment equivalent to 2% of salaries in the 2022-2023 financial year, and a 5% rise for the 2023-2024 financial year. It was rejected by members of the Royal College of Nursing last month, despite the union's boss, Pat Cullen, recommending that members should accept the offer. The Royal College of Nursing is already balloting its 300,000 members for further strike action over the next 6 months. When asked by Sky News whether the government would resume talks with the union, Health Secretary Steve Barclay said, not on the amount of pay. Talks with the British Medical Association over junior doctors' pay have also broken down after the union rejected a 5% offer, with Steve Barclay telling the BBC on Sunday they haven't moved from 35%. That's the key. Dr. Vivek Trivedi, the co-chairman of the British Medical Association's Junior Doctors Committee, said, "We've been very consistent in what we're wanting, and that's to restore the pay doctors have lost over the past 15 years, which is roughly 35% up to April of last year." In response to his podcast comment, Dr. Sharma said, "Consultants have quite simply had enough, and this is why we're being forced to ballot for industrial action." A health department spokesman said, "We urge the British Medical Association to carefully consider the likely impact of any industrial action on patients." Dame Helen Stokes-Lampard, chair of the Academy of Medical Royal Colleges, said the decisions were clinically led and first and foremost about improving the quality of healthcare. She said, "I know the team have consulted with medical experts, specialist clinicians, those who commission services, and a great number of patient groups every step of the way." She added, "Achieving consensus has not always been easy, but it has been worth it. The fact that the programme also reduces unwarranted variation across the country and helps to tackle the backlog as well as freeing valuable clinical time are also huge bonuses." But general practitioner GP leaders are worried about the knock-on effect that this will have on family doctors already struggling to cope with increasing demand. Dr. Margaret Igbo of the Royal College of GPs raised concerns that the changes could overload family doctors. She said plans to reduce the pressure on hospitals cannot be implemented in isolation without considering the impact on general practice and the huge workload and workforce pressures that GPs and their teams are facing. The British newspaper The Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Junior doctors will strike for at least 3 days every month over the summer after new pay talks with the government broke down as they upped their pay demands to 49%. The British Medical Association, the BMA, which has been demanding a 35% pay rise, said the government's offer of 5%, which was also offered to nurses and paramedics, was not credible. The junior doctors will now walk out for 72 hours from 7 a.m. local time on Wednesday, 14th of June, to 7 a.m. local time on Saturday, 17th of June. But a Department of Health source said the union had unrealistic expectations and had not only refused to shift during negotiations, but actually demanded more. It is understood the British Medical Association negotiators proposed a multi-year settlement which would have seen doctors below the rank of consultant receive a 49% boost between 2021 and 2024. The strikes are likely to undermine efforts to tackle record waiting lists and leave patients waiting longer for care. Over 500,000 appointments and operations have so far been cancelled as a result of NHS industrial action by the likes of doctors, nurses and paramedics. Junior doctors held a 4-day strike in April and a 3-day strike in March, which caused the cancellation of 370,000 appointments and operations. Around 1 million NHS staff on the agenda for change contract, which includes most employees other than doctors and dentists, have accepted an offer of a 5% pay rise and a one-off bonus payment.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. This great imam was one of the founders of the jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. He was one of the founders of the very jurisprudence of the Ahlul Bayt that represented creation, originality, and the progress of intellect. Scholars have reported from Imam al-Jawad a wonderful variety of wisdom and literature regarding noble deeds and conducts that are among the most precious maxims dealing with different educational and moral and ethical issues.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam. Dear friends, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived in an era where moral and ethical degradation and corruption was taking place. Of course, this was due to the fact that the overall Islamic Ummah and the environment began to move away from the pure and original teachings of Islam. And of course, this was due to the fact that these champions and these masters and these divinely appointed imams and leaders of Islam were cast aside, and in their place, tyrants and despots and arrogant individuals came to power, of course, which ruined the Muslim Ummah slowly but surely. Now, in this kind of environment where we find that this moral decadence has been increasing, we find that Imam al-Jawad spoke about moral virtues. He spoke about this reformation of the Muslim Ummah in order to bring it back online. Now, one of the things that we also saw was that there was a relative influx of wealth at the time of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, sure, this wealth was pretty much, you know, limited to certain groups of people or certain strata in the society. So we did have this kind of very un-Islamic class system and this very un-Islamic and unequal distribution of wealth. Nonetheless, we do find that overall there was an influx of wealth in the Muslim Ummah. So when one of the companions of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam asked His Eminence about blessings, you know, in their different various shapes and forms, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam replied to the companion and said that the blessing that is not thanked for becomes a sin that is not forgiven. And so we find here, dear brothers and sisters, that being ungrateful to the blessings that the Almighty Allah has given us is one of the sins that are not forgiven. And unfortunately, it is something that many of us do not take into consideration. We must realize all the various different blessings that we have in our lives. And so here, as we find in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad is pointing out to this fact that these blessings that we have in our life are something that must be appreciated, and we must be grateful to the Almighty Allah. And of course, this is, you know, something that we find even in the Holy Quran, where ungratefulness is equated to a shirk and to kufr, and that one who is not grateful and one who is not thankful to the Almighty Allah for their blessings is committing a sin. And how unfortunate it is that we have so many countless blessings in our life. If we start to count them, we will probably not be able to finish, right? Blessings such as health, life, you know, the ability to breathe, the ability to see, the ability to hear, the ability to speak and walk, or, you know, our families, our wives, our children, our parents, our siblings, our friends, our companions, you know, our relationship with God, you just keep on going and you will find that there are so many blessings in our lives. And, you know, when you appreciate the blessings that you have, not only do you build a stronger connection and a more intimate relationship with the Almighty Allah, but at the same time, you begin to have this very positive energy and this positive spiritual feeling within yourself because you realize all of the different blessings that you have. And of course, on the other hand, if we don't appreciate these blessings, we will not be able to create a healthy and intimate relationship with the Almighty Allah. And along with that, we will constantly have a negative view about our lives because we aren't taking into consideration everything that we have. And of course, the farther we go from these spiritual and moral ideals, the more, you know, we go towards the path of darkness, and all of this in itself becomes a sin that is not forgiven. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
There were two issues. There was the age of the imam and the color of the imam, na'udhu billah. Probably the color was used as a pretext to cover up with the age issue, that once that part was covered, then they would go to something else. Because they knew that this wouldn't really stand up, that this wouldn't really, that there's no way Imam Ridha would accept these arguments. No way. They knew that much. But they protested anyways, because it was seen to be countercultural. It was seen to be unusual. It was seen to be against the norms, which were jahil, and the reality that the imam is showing as being the true Islam and the seerah of the Prophet. Which shows that we don't need to learn today that there are cultural norms that are against, whether it be in our communities or our families, that are contrary to the teachings of Islam. Rather, these conflicts occurred very early on in Islamic history, in the early period of Islam. And these are some of the lessons that we can learn from the life of Imam al-Jawad, which is we have to ask ourselves, where does our allegiance lie? Does our allegiance lie with a set of cultural norms, with a set of constitutions, with a set of bylaws, with a set of this, you know, lives matter, and this charter, and that charter, and this charter, and that charter, the ones that we write with our own hands? Some of it may be true, some of it may not be true. Some of it may be right, some of it may not be right. Or does our allegiance lie with the Book of Allah and the Seerah and the Sunnah of the Masumeen? This is a very important test for us in how we treat others, in our marriages, how we conduct them, all of these things. All of these things. These are all the things we can learn from the struggle of Imam al-Jawad.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the past few years, major global powers have been working to ditch the US dollar, preventing Washington from further defrauding their nations by exploiting its power and weaponizing the greenback's global dominance. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today, RT Network, has covered this story and tells us more. The Russian State Duma's chairman, Vyacheslav Volodin, has censured the United States for defrauding other nations through a planned debt scheme. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the United States is on track for a debt default as early as 5th of June. The White House Council of Economic Advisers warned earlier that the possible impact of a U.S. debt default could be a downgrading of U.S. debt by a credit rating agency, followed by a worldwide recession, worldwide frozen credit markets, and plunging stock markets, in addition to mass worldwide layoffs. On Friday, 26th of May, the top Russian lawmaker, Vyacheslav Volodin, said the U.S. federal government's debt default, possibly taking place in the coming days, was a global pyramid scheme heading for an inevitable collapse. Vyacheslav Volodin, who serves as chairman of Russia's lower house of parliament, said in a Telegram post, "Just think about it. In 2023, interest payments on the U.S. debt could reach $1.5 trillion. almost a third of all U.S. budget revenue. If the proposed budget bill by the Democratic administration of President Joe Biden is not approved by the lawmakers in Washington from the opposing Republican Party, who have hinged their approval on the U.S. debt increase and decrease in public spending, the United States could default on its financial obligations to other nations. The State Duma member, Vyacheslav Volodin, wrote, "The U.S. public debt is a global financial pyramid built by Washington to defraud other nations." Volodin warned that the U.S. dollar is becoming toxic to nations dependent on the greenback. He said, "History has shown that all pyramid schemes eventually fail." The Russian State Duma's chairman, Vyacheslav Volodin, cited speeding up the current de-dollarization trend across the globe as a solution to the problem. He said, "Countries dependent on the U.S. dollar should start looking for alternatives, such as national currencies, to reduce risk for their citizens." Over the past few years, major global powers have been working to ditch the U.S. dollar, thus preventing Washington from further defrauding their nations by exploiting its power and weaponizing the greenback's global dominance. The current de-dollarization trend, which is not very new in several countries such as Venezuela, China, Russia, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and others, has proven to work. Today, powerhouses such as China and Russia and the European Union are major players in the de-dollarization process. West Asian and North African countries have also started to move away from the greenback hegemony in recent months. Countries like Iraq, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia are the main states in West Asia which have moved away from the US dollar. Brazil and Argentina have reportedly been discussing the creation of a common currency since the beginning of 2023. India studies the option of using rupees to trade non-oil commodities. In this regard, Indian Commerce Secretary Sunil Bathwal has said Indian rupee will be used in trade between countries that are facing a shortage of dollars or currency failure. He said trade between India and Malaysia can now be settled in Indian rupees. The Reuters news agency has also reported on the same issue. According to the latest data from the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, the process of diversifying away from the greenback by countries around the world is gathering pace. The statistics tracked by the Washington-based institution shows that the US dollar's share of official gold and foreign currency reserves dropped to a nearly three-decade low of 58%. In the fourth quarter of 2022. The move has reportedly been gradual, and the dollar share of central banks' foreign reserves is now nearly down to a level last seen in 1995. The long-standing status of the US dollar as the world's dominant currency has been steadily eroded in recent years amid concerns over soaring US debt and widely implemented sanctions using the currency as leverage. According to Stephen Jen, the chief executive officer of Eurozone SLG Capital Limited, the shift was more pronounced when adjusted for exchange rates, calling the decline a reaction to the freezing of half of Russia's $640 billion in gold and foreign exchange reserves. He said, "What happened in 2022 was a very sharp plummeting in the US dollar share in real terms." According to Stephen Jen, the drastic steps sparked a rethink in countries like Saudi Arabia, China, India, and Turkey about diversifying their reserves to other currencies. According to the Bank of International Settlements, the yuan's share of global over-the-counter foreign exchange transactions has increased from nearly zero 15 years ago to 7% now. BNY Mellon strategist Jeffrey Yu told the media after a move against Russia, other countries are questioning, what if you fall on the wrong side of the sanctions? Jeffrey Yu said, global central banks are currently seeking to diversify their assets, scooping up corporate debt, tangible assets such as real estate and other currencies. Mark Tinker, managing director of Tusker Fund Hong Kong, said, this is the process that is underway. The dollar is going to be used less and less in the global system. Russia's Sputnik news agency has also covered the same story. An analysis by funds flow and asset allocation data provider EPFR Global revealed emerging market investors are slowly but steadily moving away from the US dollar and US dollar-dominated debt and assets, instead preferring to park their hard currency money into local currency bonds. According to the company's figures, investors pulled out a net $2.65 billion out of primarily dollar-denominated assets between January and April of this year, but added a net $5.23 billion into local currency bond funds. Market analysts attribute the switch to attractive yields and falling inflation on local bond markets and an increasingly unattractive US dollar amid uncertainty surrounding interest rates-related volatility. The latter put a major dent in the US Treasury's attractiveness to investors and culminated in the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank in March and panic among investors. Fidelity International Emerging Markets debt portfolio manager Paul Greer expects the trend of weakened demand for dollar-denominated debt and assets to continue for the rest of the year. ABP Invest Chief Investment Officer Thanos Papasavas says, there has been a clear divergence between emerging market, local and hard currency bonds, typically dollars and other major Western currencies, over the past few quarters, with local currency debt looking more attractive on a fundamental and valuation basis. The trend of a cautious move away from the US dollar, which continues to hold the coveted status of the world's de facto reserve currency in trade, comes amid the growing risk of the US defaulting on its massive $31.8 trillion debt amid bickering between the White House and the Republicans in Congress on federal spending and the debt limit.
Hidden Files.
But Cece never saw her husband's face again because her plane crashed that morning at 10:03. What took place on 9/11 was the deadliest attack on U.S. soil ever, which took the lives of almost 3,000 people. People whom some of their heartbreaking stories have been told and retold over and over again by mainstream media. But the greatest toll this incident took was neither on September the 11th nor in America. And that's where millions more heartbreaking stories are waiting to be heard. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzieh Hashemi, and today I'm here to share with you stories of the fall of people who had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks. people who fell victim to the campaign that started following September 11th, a campaign named the War on Terror. Following the September 11th attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush declared a global military war on terror campaign. He called on world leaders to join the U.S. in this fight and said, every nation in every region now has a decision to make. Either you are with us or with the terrorists. Bush then stated how this war on terror was to unfold. Our war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but it does not end there. It will not end until every terrorist group of global reach has been found, stopped, and defeated. Well, let's look at how a lot of these events unfolded. October the 7th, 2001, airstrikes were launched in Afghanistan by the U.S. and the U.K., followed by a ground offensive. And more than 240,000 Afghans were killed as a direct result. And then if we go forward to March the 19th, 2003, U.S. and coalition forces invaded Iraq, claiming that the country had weapons of mass destruction. More than 300,000 Iraqis were killed as a direct result. Today, the War on Terror campaign continues to be used as an excuse for bombing people from Afghanistan to Yemen. According to the Cost of War Project, by 2021, over 900,000 people had been killed in the War on Terror, and over 80 countries are currently being targeted by the War on Terror today. But was this War on Terror campaign a sudden decision in the aftermath of 9/11? Or were the attacks used as an excuse to justify a full-fledged pre-planned war? Well, our first guest, Scott Ritter, who is a whistleblower and former intelligence officer, is here with us to discuss more.
Scott Ritter, United States Marine Corps intelligence officer, who was a chief weapons inspector with the UN in Iraq from 1991 to 1998. Mr. Ritter quit the inspections team in 1998. He became a whistleblower and a critic of the Bush administration's claims that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
Thanks so much for being with us, Scott, here on Hidden Files. I mean, can you explain your perspective exactly what the concept of war on terror means?
We were attacked on 9/11. Now, we can have a discussion about whether or not this was blowback from, decades of American malpractice and malfeasance in the Middle East. That's a fair point. But we did not invite this attack. We did not want this attack. We did not will this attack. We were attacked. And, you know, the world saw that and recognized that. That's why the world rallied behind the United States in the aftermath of 9/11, saying this was unwarranted. This was unjust. This was horrible. And we will support the United States. But they weren't willing to support the United States in carrying out a counteroffensive that went beyond simply punishing those who perpetrated the attack. And that's what the war on terror became. It wasn't about punishing Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. It was about American asserting dominance on an entire region, and indeed, by doing so, on the entire world. And that's what the war on terror was. It wasn't a war on terror. It was basically a war of regional and global domination by the United States using a horrible act of terrorism as justification.
Well, do you feel that there was a plan to attack Iraq even prior to the September 11th attacks?
I think the Department of Defense had been heavily engaged with Iraq over the decade of the 90s, and that there were military contingencies in place that could have the United States defeating Iraq, occupying Iraq. These were plans. They weren't necessarily fully developed. The CIA would play a supporting role in that. But there is ample evidence that the United States had plans in the works for invading and occupying Iraq prior to 9/11.
Well, what are some of the lingering effects of the U.S. war on Iraq?
the war in Iraq has never ended. I mean, it continues to this day. The political instability that we see in Baghdad is a direct consequence of the decision by the United States to invade and occupy Iraq in 2003.
Well, do you think that the U.S. would have invaded Iraq even if the 9/11 attacks hadn't taken place, since Iraq really had nothing to do with those attacks anyway?
I think the events of 9/11 accelerated the inevitable military conflict between the United States and Iraq that had been brewing for over a decade since the end of Operation Desert Storm in 1991. The Clinton administration in 1998 had put in place a law that basically codified regime change as the official policy of the United States government. And the United States was moving toward a decisive confrontation with Iraq that would have occurred whether or not 9/11 took place. I think 9/11 accelerated this, but the American public was already pre-programmed to accept the notion that Saddam Hussein was an evil that needed to be confronted and destroyed. And they were unquestioning about the weapons of mass destruction narrative that was being put forward by the United States government well before 9/11.
Well, in your perspective, who benefited from the war?
I mean, the short-term benefit was getting rid of Saddam Hussein, who had proven to be a perpetual thorn in the side of multiple American presidential administrations. His continued survival was an embarrassment to the United States. But beyond that, the United States gained no benefit. This was a colossal failure. It was a failure from almost day one. We never won over the Iraqi people. We were always seen as an occupying force. And that notion of the American occupier flew in the face of what we were trying to promote, which is the role of the United States as a liberator, promulgating the model of American democracy as something that should be emulated regionally. Instead, we became the brutal occupier, and we turned the region and indeed much of the world against us. There's nothing positive that came out of America's precipitous invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on Hidden Files, Scott Ritter. Now, the war on terror was not limited to bombing locations claimed to be terrorist hotspots in different countries. It entailed control of countries and their resources. One example of such control was when Paul Bremer, an American diplomat, was deployed to Iraq, where he became the country's chief executive authority following the U.S.'s invasion. Now, he wanted to implement 100 different orders in Iraq through one of Bremer's orders. The Iraqi army was dismantled, also using Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA. Bremer changed the Iraqi constitution to benefit American authorities. For instance, CPA's draft included banning political parties opposed to the U.S.'s occupation from participating in elections. And so from the U.S. controlling any government that would come to be in Iraq to the country even losing autonomy over its seed bank for farming, every aspect of life in Iraq was affected. Neoliberalism was being infused throughout the country, and it wasn't the Iraqi people who were profiting. There was a major heist during the occupation on so many levels, from cultural artifacts being stolen to the national wealth of the country's oil being completely controlled by the U.S. to the billions of dollars that Western contractors won. Now, let's take a look at some of these contractors.
The number of contractors on the ground outnumbered U.S. troops most years of the U.S. occupation. American politicians were invested in the contractors. Many of them owned stocks in these contractors' companies. U.S. politicians had personal interests and stocks in these contractors. 51 congressmen and women, along with their spouses, owned between $2.3 and $5.8 million worth of stocks in the top 30 defense contractor companies. The Big Five, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon and Northrop Grumman, and some others acquired the next tier of manufacturers such as Hughes Aircraft and McDonnell Douglas. In the year to June 2020, the Big Five accounted for nearly a third of the $480 billion obligated by the Pentagon to defense contractors. Meanwhile, the defense sector spent over $2.4 billion lobbying Congress since 2001. These defense contractors make direct campaign contributions to most congressional members. 1. Lockheed Martin. Total sales,